Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast.
Hello, gamer! Greetings, fellow GM and or player. Welcome to episode 101 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and I'm transmitting to you today from the Obsidian Monolith somewhere outside time and space. I have a great episode for you today. Matthew Colville is joining me to discuss the art of game mastering. He has fantastic insights on running RPGs, and he's going to share some war stories with us as well. So there are a lot of great GMing tips in this episode. You can head on over to the website and check out the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney/101. And there will be lots of links in there to a lot of the things we talk about, as well as some fantastic videos on Matt's YouTube channel. So this is a really excellent interview, and I really appreciate Matthew spending the time to talk with me today. This is a great episode for anyone running games, and also anyone who hasn't run a game, to maybe help you get over that hump and try running your first game. It's really not that bad. It's a lot of fun. And if you're a new GM or you're considering becoming a new GM, Matthew has a lot of great advice for you in this interview and also on his YouTube channel. So I really want to put the spotlight on this interview today. So I'm going to be foregoing a lot of the segments this week, but they'll be back next week for episode 102. So without further ado, I'm going to fire up the communications array here on the Obsidian Monolith, and we're going to talk with Matthew about the art of being a dungeon master. The main reason I'm doing this is because I think your YouTube channel is awesome, so I want people to know about it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm glad that you're getting a kick out of it. But you already run D&D.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So you're not. I saw you're running Curse of Strahd. How yes. are you finding that?
I'm digging it so far. I think it's the best fifth edition official adventure that they put out so far by far.
Interesting. What is it you think that separates it from, like, were the other ones bad?
Tyranny of Dragons was, it took a lot of work. I ran the first half of that. It took a lot of work to make it work.
Interesting. I heard a lot of people say that.
Yeah, it was partly because they were actually developing that at the same time Wizards was developing 5th edition, so they didn't have the final rules.
Well, I noticed that the first couple of adventure paths, I don't know what to call them, the big super modules they're putting out, were not done internally. They were outsourcing them to, like, I think Green Ronin did one, and Wolfgang Bauer's company did one. I think that was the Tyranny of Dragons one.
Yeah.
And now, but I think Curse of Strahd is in-house.
Yes,
it is. And it makes me wonder if maybe they detected that the quality, that people were not reacting to the adventures the way they hoped. And so they're like, we have to bring this internal. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's based on the original adventure.
Like, yeah. I-6, I think it was.
Yeah. And Tracy Hickman was involved with this one. And it's just really well written. It's fairly open-ended, but it's not like a total sandbox. I played a little bit of Princes of the Apocalypse, and that one was so sandboxy that I just felt like there wasn't any real direction to it.
Yeah, that's always a problem with a sandbox game, is that it's up to the players to kind of figure out what are we going to do. And players often feel lost at sea when they're given, you know, infinite freedom to do stuff. One of the things I like about Curse of Strahd is that that's the game that Chris Perkins is running on Dice Camera Action. So if you're a DM trying to figure out how do I run this?
Yeah.
You can just go watch him and you see literally how he ran it. And it's my impression of it is that it's super, like, how do I put this? It is super railroady. Like, you don't, but that's the nature of Ravenloft. Like, you don't decide to go to Ravenloft. Right. There's never a point where the players are like, we should kill Strahd. It's like, no, we have to kill him to get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that it's funny because it results, I think, in, I wonder if his players, or do your players know, like, did you tell them ahead of time, look, we're going to do this adventure called Curse of Strahd and you're going to get stuck in another dimension. And there's not much, that's the adventure. So if you make a character that has some kind of backstory that you can't explore outside of this universe, you're going to be screwed.
Yeah, I did. And I even went so far as to say, you know, don't spend a lot of time because their characters came from Forgotten Realms.
Right.
So I was like, don't spend a lot of time on things in your background that are relevant to the realms because it's not going to come.
Well, that's good. You're a good DM. because I think like that's a mistake I would probably make is I come from that tradition where you don't necessarily want to tell the players what adventure you're running. Maybe that's because back in the 80s when I was a teenager, like, people would cheat. They would go find the adventure and read it. But like, it was fun to discover, like, we'd be halfway through an adventure and the DM would show us the module he was running. And it was neat to find out this is custom crafted content that we've discovered.
Yeah.
But if I did that with Ravenloft, I would end up with unhappy players because I would definitely end up with players that had backstories that they expected to play out over the course of the game. And unless that backstory takes place in this pocket universe, it's not gonna, there's nothing for it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very railroady as far as like how it brings you in to the adventure and as far as like you have to do this thing to get out of Ravenloft.
Yeah.
But as far as how the PCs go about it, it's very open-ended, even to the point where, I mean, they can go try to take on Strahd and right away if they want. And die horribly, or they can wait until their 10th level, or they can wait until their 15th level.
Oh, that's cool.
So, and it recommends the milestone XP method, and it gives some suggestions for here are some possible milestones, but it doesn't even spell out the milestone. So as a DM, you can kind of decide, like I kind of went through it and I was like, I kind of want them to be about 15th level if they do everything.
Wow. Right.
And so I kind of set up the milestones that way because Strahd himself is like CR 15.
Right.
So,
but you can throw like a CR 15 monster against a 15th level party is going to get wiped out. I mean, I think the assumption is that he's going to be in his lair. He's going to get all his lair actions. He's going to have minions helping him out. One of the things I really like about 5th edition is that you can use high level bad guys against your players when they're low level. You just have to tweak, like give them fewer hit points or, tweak them a little bit. But that I remember playing in the playtest and the DM I was playing with threw a Medusa at us and we were first level.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, this is nonsense. I was upset at my friend because I was like, you can't. And he was like, look, according to the rules, this is legal. And the Medusa turned me to stone. I was dead. But the party won. Like one player got screwed, but the other five players succeeded. And I was like, that's actually pretty impressive. I would have expected in an earlier edition of the game, the Medusa would just wipe out the party if you're all first level.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened. And I thought, oh, that's cool.
Another thing I like about it is kind of the opposite is even when characters are high level, you can still throw low level stuff like kobolds at them and they can still be effective.
Yeah. I told my players early on, especially I have two groups and one of them is composed almost entirely of newbies and my Thursday night group. And I told them, here is how you guys normally this, I would not give the players, I try to avoid like telling the players how to play. Right. Cause that's something that they should have the fun of figuring out. But just to save them from dying, I said, if you guys ever get in a scenario where you are outnumbered, that is worse than fighting something that is much higher level than you.
Yeah.
Because once you have bad guys getting more actions than you guys, then they're more likely to hit because your armor class never gets that high. You know, a kobold still has like +4 to hit or something. So there's still like a 40% chance that half CR guy is going to hit you. And when there's eight of them, then they're going to do damage.
Yeah. And kobolds are especially scary. There's a lot of them in Tyranny of Dragons because whenever a kobold is within 5 feet of another kobold, it gets advantage on its attack, which is, I think, equivalent to like a +5.
Yeah, it's mathematically equivalent to plus five.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the things, that's one of the things I miss about fourth edition is that, like, I liked, and they preserved some of that. Like, they give the orcs the charge, and they have, I think goblins get their free shift still.
Yeah.
But I miss having, you know, several different types of kobolds that I can use without any prep work on my end. Like, I have to, like, what is a kobold shaman? I don't know. That's work. I have to make that up on the fly. And yeah. I often do. I often just, you know, I don't even know ahead of time what spells. I just look at the cleric spell list and go, no, I'll give him that spell.
Yeah.
On the fly, which is fine. I think that's what Mike Merles would say. Good. That's what you're supposed to
right.
do. Yeah. Right. But I liked having that work kind of done for me and have to be, oh, here's a kobold dragon shield. Here's a kobold shaman. Here's a kobold chieftain. Having those stats already done made my life a lot easier.
You know, it might have been you on your one of your videos, but I heard someone say that they needed a I think it was a goblin shaman, and they just gave them the spells from the adept and just kind of tacked that on to the goblin.
Yeah, I think like that's in one of the videos when I talk about like what is a goblin shaman.
Right.
Like, I don't know, just make it up. Like, go and look at go and look at other things in the monster. Like, I do that all the time when I want this monster to be a little bit different than his brothers. Yeah. I will just go look at other creatures in the monster manual and go, oh, this ability that, you know, a Zorn has is neat. I'll just give that ability to this bad guy. And, you know, the players don't know it. I think that especially with new players, they can learn bad lessons early. And when you teach, when they experience, oh, they're fighting a bunch of kobolds or goblins or orcs or whatever, and some of them are different. Like, this orc is a bloodwalker. What does that mean? Well, it means he has regeneration, right? And the players learn, oh, they're not all carbon copies out of the monster manual.
Yeah.
If they think they are, if players come up learning that, like, this is what a goblin is, these are the stats for a goblin, and if it doesn't have these stats, then it's not a goblin, then they will rebel when you start changing things up because they're like, no, this is the rule. So I think that establishing that kind of variety early makes it so players don't learn bad lessons.
Yeah, that's great advice. One thing I like to do is I try, and I'm pretty bad at this, but I try not to use the creature's name. Oh, so they don't know what it is.
Yeah. You just describe them. Yeah. I like, especially that's one of the things I enjoy about playing very low level is that neither the players nor like the local villagers know what these things are often. So they'll describe them as like demons, like a bunch of demons attacked the carter, and the players like they can't be demons, can they? You know, but they don't know. They don't know what exactly they are. Are they troglodytes? Are they goblins? And that process of figuring that out can be fun.
Yeah. You kind of brought this up. I'm curious because I know you, it seems like you might have more experience with fifth edition than I do. I started out trying to build encounters using the system in the DMG.
Yeah.
And I found it a little time consuming. And also sometimes I got results I wasn't expecting from it.
Right.
And then I saw on an AMA on Reddit, you know, someone asked Mike Merles about, you know, how do you do encounters on the fly? And he said, you know, if it's one monster, you know, throw something the CR of the party or lower. If you want a group of monsters, throw like 3 to 5 of them, like half the CR of the party or lower.
Right.
So I was curious, do you like how do you build encounters? Do you use the DMG method or?
I'll tell you how I do it.
Okay.
I throw whatever I think is cool in there in numbers I think are going to be impressive. And then I worry about the math while we play.
Okay.
Right. I make no concession to the math of D&D. I don't think about that at all. I'm just like, for instance, I'll give you an example. I'm running Night Below, and Night Below is a classic second edition adventure that came out in like 1994. If you can find a copy of it, it's one of the best things TSR ever did. And there's a point where the players have to assault a keep, like a classic. There are orcs that it's like a third level section of the adventure very early on. And I've got a map of the keep and I've made notes and I'm like, you know what? They've been fighting a lot of goblins. They've already fought some orcs. I want to make this interesting. I don't want to just be more orcs. So I gave the orcs a bunch of hellhounds.
Cool.
Just because I thought hellhounds were neat and the players hadn't fought them yet. And part of me in the back of my mind, part of me is saying, if I don't use hellhounds now, will I ever use them? Like, you never know. How long, right? How long is this campaign going to last? I don't know. I want to make sure the players experience lots of different cool monsters. Now, an orc with a hellhound doesn't make any sense, right? Like, the hellhound would have the orc, right? Hellhounds are like higher level. They're way nastier. And so what I do is on the fly, I just kind of adjust the hellhound's hit points mostly down. because the players, they don't know that a Hellhound is supposed to have 44 hit points. And if they found out, they would freak out, especially since I'm using, in some cases, there's like a whole kennel of Hellhounds in here, right? And the players have already heard the keening of the hounds. So they know, A, there's a lot of them in there. And they've heard, I think, the orcs, they've overheard the orcs talk about the kennels. So they know that there's a bunch of these things all in one place. So I can't have them all have 44 hit points. Otherwise, they're just going to wipe out the party. But there's nothing else really about, like, they have fire breath that does like 66 damage. Uh-huh. So that's one of those things where I probably won't have the Hellhounds use the fire breath as tactically optimal as I could, okay. Right? I'll have them lunge and jump into battle, bite, claw, use their other attacks. And then as a dramatic spice, I'll have them breathe fire. And there may be a player who goes, you know what? If these Hellhounds just all breathed fire on us, we would all be dead. But that is accurate, but they're dogs, right? These things are not tactical geniuses. Right. So the players, they buy it. So no, I don't ever worry about, encounter. I used to be super anal about that stuff, but I found that between me just making up what I thought was dramatic and just adjusting the numbers on the fly, everything works out fine. The players have a great time and they end up fighting a lot of monsters they wouldn't fight otherwise.
Do you have a rule of thumb when it comes to how many creatures you throw at them, or?
You know, it depends on whether or not I think. I mean, generally speaking, we start with few and we work up to many. Like with the keep, the players are outside the keep and they're watching and they're investigating. And so I have an orc patrol come by and it's just one orc and one hellhound. Done. Right. Yeah. And that is not an encounter that's really good. And for an encounter like that, the challenge isn't, are we going to kill the orc and the hellhound? Of course they are. That is not. The math there doesn't work out to challenging the party. The challenge is, can we kill them before they alert the keep? Yeah. Right. So there are lots of ways to challenge your players without just grinding down their hit points. So that's the first encounter. And then the second encounter is probably going to be a couple of orcs and a hellhound at the gates, you know, or, you know, a patrol when they go in. And then eventually they will fight a lot of orcs with a couple of hellhounds. And so I just try to escalate it up. I think I've gone through periods as a DM where I felt like every encounter had to challenge the party, but that's bad. You definitely want opportunities for the players to win easily, get to show off. Yeah. Like there are some things that regenerate on a short rest. And so if you give the players the opportunity to bust those things out without fear of something else happening, they feel more heroic, right? They're like, oh, I can use this cool power now and be badass against this thing, and I'll get a chance to rest right after, so I'll get it back. Players often worry about when is the right time to use this power. And so giving them lots of chances to use their cool abilities makes them happy.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really cool because, you know, I've been struggling a lot with, you know, how to build encounters in this edition, and I've tried all kinds of different things. And it just seems like the actual like randomness of the dice seems to have more impact than the actual math of the encounter, because I've had encounters that by the numbers should have been, you know, super challenging or even deadly. And
the players just walk through it.
Yeah. Through good tactics and lucky rolls. And then I've had encounters that seemed like they would be super easy and ended up almost killing everybody just because the players were really unlucky or the monsters were really lucky.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you as a DM just have a night where you can't roll less than 17, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter what the encounter is. They're going to lose. You're going to win. And so that's the reason we have the DM screen, is to kind of like, there are times when you need to keep the bad guys alive longer than the math says they should be alive, just because otherwise the players are going to walk through this encounter. And especially if it's an encounter that's intended to be kind of momentous and have some import and be dramatic, it cheats the player. Players don't like winning trivially when it's supposed to be the big moment of the night.
Right.
So yeah, you definitely have to, once you get to the point where you're fudging the numbers anyway, like I should do a video on this. Like, a friend of mine who's a player in my Tuesday night game, and is one of the people I've identified as being a potential DM, right? You can kind of tell like which players would be good at it.
Yeah.
He showed up for the Thursday night game because we're all coworkers, and he kind of wanted to see how these guys were playing. And I said, you want to help me run the bad guys? And he was like, sure. And the one problem I had was, how do I communicate to my friend Lars when to take it easy on the party and when to be hard on them without me actually telling him, because I don't want them to know that. Right. So what I did was I just took a D6 behind the DM screen. I said, this is the threat die, right? When it's high, I want you to do everything you can. We don't need to communicate. Just use your smartest, best Final Fantasy tactics to screw these guys. And then I can control the die and turn the die down. And it worked great because there were times when I was like, okay, we're going a little bit overboard here. And so I would just dial the die down. And when Lars would run the zombies or whatever, he would have them do things suboptimally, right? And of course, you know, very few bad guys are as smart as the players. Yeah. So there's some wiggle room there when it comes to bad guy behavior that lets you, the DM, kind of take it easy on them. Like that, if I'd been playing that zombie, he would have done this. Yeah, but he's just a zombie, so he didn't do that.
Right.
I'll often also have, like, I'll just roll a die. I'll say, so usually I do it in front of the players, but then I do it behind the screen enough so that they don't sus to it. And I'll say, like, okay, this guy is going to, I just point to the players and I give them a number. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I roll a die, right? Even though realistically there is an optimal player to attack, mm-hmm. I'll randomize it so the players feel like it's not me doing it. But then behind the screen, I'll just pick somebody, right? I'll pick the character with the most hit points, or I'll pick the character that hasn't been attacked. And that way we just maintain that narrative flow. So we want the illusion of it's all down to the math and the die rolls, but us behind the screen as the DM, we have, you know, ultimate power, and there's nothing for it. There's no solution. There's no math you can do that is going to teach you exactly. You just got to run the game a lot. And then you start learning, okay, I can pretty much throw anything I want at these guys as long as I do it the right way.
Yeah. Cool.
So there. See, I told you. I can talk for a long time on like very, very few questions.
Yeah, I was just gonna say I don't think we even need the questions. This is already better than what I had planned.
Well, one of the things you asked and that made me think was who was the best character I ever played, and that's something I haven't talked a lot about. I haven't talked anything about me as a player.
Well, let's come to that in a second because there's a couple things that you talked about. One thing that I think you kind of mentioned this is I always look at the intelligence of the whatever it is. And if it's less than 10, I mean, this thing is dumber than the average human.
So sure. Yeah.
It's not going to be making tactically optimal decisions.
Correct.
Probably.
Right. Yeah. Although I have played in games like one of the best DMs, maybe the best DM I've ever played with, my friend Jim. He had the wizard. We were playing third edition and our group's wizard, we were fighting a bunch of dire cobras, if I remember correctly. And these cobras would ready their attack actions to interrupt the wizard spellcaster. And that, you know, as he was trying to cast a spell, right, to try to force them to make concentration checks, which by any reasonable definition is complete nonsense, right? But it was one of those kind of like you really felt like you're John McClane and you're getting your butt kicked the entire way. I think all players want to be John McClane. They want to get their butt kicked and win all the way through. Yeah. And I remember my friend Steve playing the wizard looked at Jim and he goes, yeah, they're just dumb animals, but they know I'm the spellcaster, right? And that's that. But even though he was complaining, he was doing it with a smile on his face. He thought it was funny. So I think you can get away. If depending on the kind of game you're running, you can get away with giving the monsters knowledge that, that you, the DM, have, but that the monsters wouldn't realistically have. It's just down to the tone of your game and what your players expect.
Yeah, and you can have a lot of fun with the smarter creatures. I had an encounter where one of the enemies was a pretty smart wizard who had Counterspell, which is super powerful in this edition. Yeah. And he just locked down the PC spellcasters for the entire combat. He just Counterspelled like every round.
I haven't even looked at Counterspell. That's awesome. I should check it out.
Yeah, it's a reaction.
So oh, nice. As long as you don't have to spend your
as long as you got a spell slot, you can just cancel a spell. And the next time the PC's leveled, like someone took Counterspell.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Because they've learned. They saw it used against them. Yeah. I was going to say something. Now I can't remember what. Oh, yeah. No, there was a great article in Dragon Magazine a million years ago about how to run super genius characters like dragons that have like a 25 intelligence and stuff like that. And the advice, and it might have been from Skip Williams, the advice was have everybody roll initiative, have them tell you what they're going to do on their turn, and then you have the dragon act with that knowledge, but they still have to do what they said they were going to do.
Oh, cool.
Right. Like the dragon is so smart that it knew you were going to do that. And it acted or reacted in such a way as to take advantage of that. And there's nothing the players can do at that point. They're kind of locked in. And I've never tried that. I think it would take a little bit of work, but that seemed like a super cool idea. A great way to kind of show the players this guy is not only smarter than you, he's smarter than me, the DM. So this is how we're going to play that out.
Nice.
I'm running a campaign online right now, and I stream it. And I ask the players at the beginning, because I play on Roll20, and Roll20 will let you as a GM make your rolls so the players can't see it.
Right.
And I asked the players, I said, do you want my rolls to be visible to you or not? You know, if it's visible, then I can't cheat.
Right. Yeah.
I can't cheat to hurt you. I can't cheat to help you. And so they decided they wanted them to be public. And I've actually had more character deaths than I would normally have because I can't cheat.
Right. I mean, and that's, I think that even that notion of quote unquote cheating is, it's nonsense. Right.
Yeah. I shouldn't say cheat. Yeah.
Well, but we do, because the players need to feel like what's happening is real. If they don't feel that, then it becomes all just like ephemeral. It doesn't, the players need, it breaks suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
If the players don't feel as though what's happening is how it would have gone. And so, yeah, I know, like, I've played with groups that are used to the DM only ever. That's one of the things about my channel, is that when I tell people you can do A or B, a lot of people in the comments think I'm saying you must do A. Like, if I say you can run behind a screen, here's how I do it, they're thinking I'm saying you must do it behind a screen.
Yeah.
But no, I've had DMs that never used a screen and thought it was silly. But like, I do a little bit of both. I roll in front of the players and I roll behind the screen. And I have played with people that are used to DMs that only ever roll behind the screen. And when I start rolling in front of them, they are like, I visibly freaked out, right? Like, that die that is about to land, Matt can't change it. So yeah. If he crits, there's nothing like it. It's fun because it raises that level of tension and it makes the players believe this is real. Let the dice fall where they may is a great ethos.
Yeah. And I have to say, though, after doing both, I definitely prefer to be able to do, which I think is what you said in your video that you do, where sometimes you roll in front of the screen and then sometimes you roll behind it.
Yeah, I try to roll behind the screen about 40% of the time, just so, even though I only need to about 10% of the time. But that 40% makes it so that I'm doing it out on one side of the screen, on the other side of the screen, it's going back and forth. So the players don't make the association, oh, he's rolling behind the screen because he's trying to take it easy on us.
Right, yeah. Or he's trying to make his bad guy live longer.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Which I'm not a huge fan of. I don't like it when, I mean, I've had to do that. I've had scenarios where one of my players' plan was so good that if I hadn't fudged the numbers behind the screen and kind of, you know, done a bunch of crazy stuff on the fly, the entire boss battle for the entire campaign, somebody they'd been hearing about and dealing with for 5 levels, would have taken about 3 rounds and the bad guy would never have gotten to do his stuff. And so on the one hand, that player, the one with the plan, he wants his plan to come to fruition. That's the juice for him. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if that had happened, it would have been super anticlimactic for everybody, including him.
Yeah.
So I had to keep that bad guy alive. I wasn't trying to do it because I love this bad guy. I was doing it because I didn't want this epic moment to happen in the wink of an eye.
Yeah, totally.
Everyone would have sat around being like, is that it? You know, that being said, I mean, there are, especially, I think, you know, having there be encounters that the players can completely bypass just through, you know, clever role playing, does a good job. Like I had an encounter where the Thieves Guild were coming to attack the players in the city. And one of the players was running a thief, and I had drawn out the map and put minis out. Right. So this was, we rolled initiative, and the thief rolled high initiative. So it was his turn. And I said, Ray, what are you going to do? And he used his charisma and he bluffed these guys and said, hey, we are members of the opposing Thieves Guild. Are you sure you want to go to war over this? And the thieves were like, whoa, we didn't know you were gilded. And that he just rolled really well, and he bypassed that entire encounter. And the other players were like, holy moly, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know that was on the table, that you could just like you could just be clever and be smart and bypass an entire encounter. They kind of felt like these were new players. They felt like they were on rails. They felt like there was a script.
Right.
And I'm like, no, man, it's up to you guys. This is going to go how you guys want. It's not going to be, you know, there is no script. If you guys are clever enough and come up with something cool and roll well, then that's probably going to happen.
Yeah, there was a moment in one of your videos for new GMs about how to run the game that gave me kind of that eureka moment, where you were talking about, you were throwing a stone giant, I think it was, in like a first level adventure.
Right.
Just because it's like, this is something that if they fight it, it's going to go very badly. They have to find some other way. And especially with a new group or new players, you know, that that's a way to kind of, like you said, let them know, hey, you know, you guys can go outside the box here. I thought that was awesome.
There, another thing that, you know, players, it's interesting because one of the things that I, as a player, is just because of the way I came up, I'm always looking at the combat and thinking, all right, should we bug out? Should we retreat? And there'll be a time when I think, yeah, we got to get the hell out of here. And I will pick my mini up on my turn and I'll start leaving. I'll say, we're getting the hell out of here. But for some reason I have noticed, I think because modern players are not used to that kind of sandbox open world element, they think if we're in this encounter, it must be solvable. It must be. Matt would not have put this in front of us if we can't do it. Yeah. And it's like, no, man, that's not how it works. It's entirely possible for you to get yourself in trouble and get in over your head. And when that happens, it's up to you to decide, we need to get the hell out of here. So I've seen players just get stubborn and get, just because they're so frustrated because they can't see a way to win. And they assume there must be a way to win that they will stubbornly like throw themselves at the encounter just to make a point. And I'm like, I don't know what you're doing. Like, you should have ran. Like, this was not like, but players don't, that it's down to a style of play. I think players who've come up in the heavily scripted kind of on rails game, they assume that if they go over here and encounter this thing, that it must be possible to solve this problem.
Yeah, totally.
But I think, yeah, I mean, that depending on the game you're running, the answer is no. If the players are self-directed, if it was, look, it was your idea to go over here. It wasn't my idea. It was your idea to go over here. At that point, you know, the gloves are off. Anything can happen.
Yeah.
I ran a game at work at Pandemic Studios, my first video game job. And I told the players the map. I gave them a map of the area. I said, the map does not know what level you guys are. Right. So if you guys want to go over here, and you never know what will happen. And they went to a keep and they fought a wizard, and the wizard had cast True Strike, which in third edition gives you like plus 20 to hit.
Yeah.
And I rolled in front of the players and I rolled a 6. Right. He was casting a spell. He had Shocking Grasp and he needed to hit in melee. So he rolls a 6 and they're like, OK, he missed us. And I'm like, all right, I hit an AC of 29. And they're like, holy crap, this wizard is plus 23 to hit. Right. And then I rolled Shocking Grasp damage, and I just, by sheer luck behind the screen, I rolled all 6s on 6 dice. So they don't know that I just did max damage. They think 36 damage is roughly average, right? And they're like, this is a lich. We need to get the hell out of here. And they retreated. They ran, right? And I was like, that's funny, because my fifth level wizard just convinced these guys that he was actually a lich. And that whole encounter probably wouldn't have gone that way if the players had believed and assumed that this wizard must be something that is legal for us to fight, because otherwise Matt wouldn't put it in front of us. Because they had that idea in their head that they could be in way over their heads, they were very sensitive to, what is this thing? Could it be a high-level wizard?
Awesome.
Yeah, anyway.
Well, tell me about some of your player characters.
I mean, I've been playing the game for a long time, and I have a lot of great characters that I've enjoyed, but I think the number one character I played was in my friend Jim's game, set in mythic, like prehistoric England, in Albion, which was, and he had there was a magazine that a company called SPI put out a million years ago called Ares Magazine. And each issue of Ares Magazine had a game in it. And one of the issues had a game, like a little board game called Albion, and it came with a hex map. And so Jim's like, I'm going to use this hex map for my game. And it was fantastic because he made it very sandboxy. We could go wherever we wanted. And because it was set in quote unquote, the real world, like England is a real place in our world, people started asking questions like, could I be from France? And he's like, yeah, if you want to be like somebody from another place that's washed up on the shores of England, that's fine. It's just prehistoric, you know, France. It's not, you know, it's not like the Crusaders. And I was like, wait, could I be from like Atlantis? And he was like, sure. And so I invented this, because I figure it's mythic prehistory, right? And Atlantis is perfect for that.
Yeah.
So I made a character who was kind of from a high, quote unquote, high tech. So like, this is a character from like the 13th century who has found himself washed up in like the 3rd century BC. So my character knows stuff about like agriculture and stuff like that. And these guys have no idea. And so I played this character. His name was Saket the Atlantean. I played him for like 9 or 10 levels. And that was fantastic, mostly because I took it upon myself to kind of teach the local dirt farmers how to be a civilized nation. And we ended up with a huge getting involved in politics with the local elves. These are like you know, not Tolkien-esque elves. These are kind of more guerrilla warfare elves.
Okay.
And there was a whole session we had where the king of one tribe of elves came to treat with us. And we spent the entire night, we spent 4 hours role-playing this diplomatic engagement. And I don't think any of us ever rolled any dice. And that was some of the most fun I've ever had playing D&D, was just negotiating with this king of the elves about how this human society was going to be left alone. And so that was probably the most fun I've had as a player.
Awesome. Sounds great.
I mean, it's hard to pick sometimes, but yeah. Saket the Atlantean, it was pretty amazing.
That's really cool. That sounds like a fun campaign.
It was great. Yeah, it was Jim. I think a lot of the stuff in my current campaign I've ripped off from Jim's game. Like my character, we met, we fought a bunch of goblins on a tower, and they'd taken over this elven tower, and we cleared out, and the goblins had, the tower was the tower of the Oracle, and the Oracle was a Medusa, right, behind a screen. And the Medusa could tell you the future if you perform the right rituals. And my character took that tower over. And as a result, I had this oracle in my tower that I could ask questions to. And if I asked the question the right way, and if the signs were right, if the stars were aligned, I would get this, you know, useful answer. And that was super cool. That was just something my friend Jim invented, and I have since stolen it.
Yeah, what a great tool for the GM to bring in plot hooks or give you crucial information.
Yeah, without making it too obvious, right? Like because it's an oracle, like the Oracle of Delphi, he could couch it in kind of cryptic language.
Very cool.
But it was a lot of fun. It was a great game.
So how about any favorite stories from the other side of the screen?
Well, you know, I think one of my best stories I told in the video about my friends, my friend Robbie, who role played a green slod. that's one of the most epic things that's happened in the game. I ran a game. In fact, it was the first time I ran Night Below back in the 90s. It was set in my Birthright game. One of my players, these players started at relatively high level.
Okay.
And so one of them said that he wanted to be a wizard and a member of the Royal College of Sorcery. And I'm like, that's cool. And he decided he was going to be like the best abjurer in the college. So he was the alienist was the title we gave him. And one of the other players was like, it would be cool. This wizard player is like, it would be neat if one of the other characters was like my bodyguard, because I summon these things from beyond time and space, and I need a powerful fighter there in case all my wizard wards don't work. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. And my friend Mark was like, that would be cool. I'd like to play that guy. And then in the car, he said, like just him and me, he was like, I want some kind of cool, like nefarious backstory. I would like to play somebody who is not what he seems and is actually maybe not on the player's side. And I was like, well, it would be cool if you as a bodyguard to this high level wizard are really a mole from the Thieves Guild and have been for years. And the whole mission in Night Below is to find out what's happening to these kidnapped spellcasters. So maybe there's somebody that's been kidnapped that you are the wizard player is going to go down there and try to rescue this guy. And you are there to make sure that doesn't happen.
Oh.
And to kill that NPC wizard if and when you get down there. So if you guys don't make it, if you guys never catch up to the wizard, if you never find out, then you get to keep your cover. But otherwise, and it came down to after years of play, like we played every week for 3 years, the players managed to get to the end of Night Below. They found the captive spellcasters. The wizard PC found his buddy that he'd been looking for. And it's like, okay, we can get out of here. And at that point, my friend Mark used his initiative, leapt forward and executed that guy and revealed himself as an agent of the Thieves Guild. And he had been one the entire time. And he had the means, he had taken care as they got magic items to get him stuff that would allow him to get out of dodge when he needed to. Right. So having executed this guy, he was able to get out. And then the wizard PC had to follow him. And so every campaign I've run since then, I've had as guest stars, this wizard chasing this fighter, like across dimensions, right?
Oh,
because
cool.
Now they are going to struggle throughout time. And my friend Craig, the wizard player, was legitimately angry at the player Mark. And he was like, dude, we were buddies. And Mark's like, yeah, man, it was all an act. And that, you know, it was amazing. And my friend Mark loved it because he liked being at peace with the idea that this may never come up. This part of his backstory, they might never catch up to these wizards. They might catch up to him and the wizard NPC that he was supposed to kill might already be dead. In which case, no one would ever, he was okay with that. And so once the opportunity arose for him to actually reveal who he was and what his mission was the entire time, he was over the moon. He was like, he had a blast. And it was a super memorable, even though Craig was legitimately angry. That was an incredibly memorable campaign. My friends still talk about it. And so that kind of stuff is what makes people play D&D. Those are the kind of stories that the players invent. That can't happen in a game like Skyrim or Baldur's Gate.
Now, I'm curious, did the wizard player, did he eventually get over it and be like, okay, that was pretty cool? Or was he just always pissed about it?
I'm going to see him in about half an hour, so I can ask him. Okay. I know that whenever it comes up, he acts like he's still upset about it.
Okay.
But I've known this guy for almost 30 years now. I believe he's acting like that on purpose because it is fun to play along.
Yeah.
I think he actually thinks that it was pretty awesome. Yeah, I mean, the whole there's lots of stuff like that where, you know, I let the players kind of do the kind of crazy stuff they want to do and they love it.
Yeah. And that's so much more interesting and fun than a player playing the rogue that's just constantly picking the pockets of other people in a party, you know?
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, Mark legitimately risked his life over and over again to keep this, my friend Craig's wizard, alive. And so he was beyond reproach. There were instances where the players thought that the Thieves Guild was shadowing them, that the Thieves Guild had some kind of interest in what the party was doing. But whatever they thought, they never in a million years thought it had anything to do with Mark. And so, yeah, when that happened, it was all purely player directed. Like, my friend Craig came up with the idea of who his wizard was and the idea of being an alienist. And my friend Mark came up with the idea of being a mole for the Thieves Guild. And I was like, you know what? If that's what you guys want to do, absolutely.
That's brilliant. I love it.
You can not be a mole agent of the Thieves Guild in any game. Only in D&D, only in D&D can you do it.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, and I will link to the video you mentioned with the story about the green slot in the show notes because that's a really great story too, and a great way to kind of explain what's so cool about these games to people that don't have any experience with them.
Yeah, like this, it's one of those things where I'm lucky that I work in video games, so I'm surrounded by nerds. So when I need someone to kind of play an NPC, or I can run two groups at once, I can have them both in the same world, and it's just Tuesdays and Thursdays. Those are opportunities that I suspect most DMs don't have, so I try to take advantage of them. Like the bad guy in the third, one of the bad guys, because there's more than one, in my Thursday night group. And it's up to the players to decide which of these bad guys do we want to engage with, right? There's all sorts of people moving around in the world. One of them is a vampire queen, and I'm kind of thinking that maybe I would use her in place of Strahd, and maybe she's an agent of Strahd, if the players ever decide that they want to go down that path. But she's a vampire queen that started off as my friend Jess from that video, who was a player.
Okay.
And she was playing an elf. And the crazy thing was the party had recovered this artifact sword, this elven artifact sword that has crazy powers that they have not unlocked. And she had just joined the group, but she was the only elf. So they're like, you should have this sword. And she's like, great. So she's got this she's an elf. Even though she's an elf priest, elves can use longswords. So she's got this badass elven weapon, and they're fighting the bad guy, and the bad guy is a powerful necromancer, and this is a trick I've used a couple times. I'm going to make a video about this. They kill this necromancer, but he is a scion of Orcus, and Orcus says, no, I'm not done with you. I have plans for you. Rise. And now he comes back and he's like a lich, right? And they have to fight him again, right? And they have to beat him again, right? And nice. And that was epic, and they loved that. But one of the powers I gave him, I just made this up. One of the powers I gave him was that if you were unconscious, right, he could use his action and kill you and raise you as some kind of undead. You had to make a saving throw. And the players knew this because they have an NPC squire who was unconscious, and I had this bad guy use his power, and he failed. The NPC made her saving throw. So they knew this guy can do something. Don't go unconscious. If somebody drops to unconscious, heal them quickly, because we don't want to find out what's going to happen. And unfortunately, because of the way things worked out, Jess's elven priest with this longsword went unconscious, and the bad guy used his ability, and she failed her save, and she was resurrected as like a vampire spawn.
Oh, cool.
And so now she is a bad guy in this encounter. And she, not only when they finally beat this this lich, she stayed a vampire and tried to stop them from leaving. And so I just gave Jess the stats for vampire and said, here, this is your character now. And she goes, do I still have all my spells? And I'm like, sure. And so she's doing everything she can to stop the players. I made, I don't know if you, did you play fourth edition?
I did not.
Oh, you missed some really cool mechanics. One of the ones I stole from fourth edition is the idea of a skill challenge. The idea that like, okay, you guys have killed the bad guy and now his fortress is collapsing. I'm not going to make you tactically move square by square through the entire ruined keep. We're just going to have this cinematic escape scene where each of you has a couple of skills you can use to try to help the party get out, and you have to get, you know, four successes before you collectively get three failures.
Okay.
And if you, you know, and there are different results for how many failures they get. And so now Jess is literally on a round by round basis trying to thwart the players, and she almost caused one or two of them to die in the collapsing keep, but she didn't. And now her character, Lady Serial, I've promoted her to big bad guy. But she's not the bad guy for that party. She's the bad guy for the other D&D party I run at work.
Oh, cool.
So now they're like, who is this character? There's a point where, yeah, it's crazy. That's the kind of thing I can do. I can use this PC who died and got resurrected in the Tuesday game. I can use her as the bad guy for the Thursday game because I'm surrounded by nerds and I can run D&D like crazy.
That's awesome.
So we'll see what happens. I don't know if they're going to, they haven't really met or dealt with her yet. So I think that she's only been sending her agents at them, and the time's going to come when they've thwarted her agents and she's going to show up.
Yeah. And that's a great example of a way, like say for instance, like we were talking about before, you have this epic encounter that you've planned and it's just going really easily for the PCs, you know, doing something like that is a much better way to get that drama you want other than just adding a bunch of hit points to the monster behind the screen.
Right. Like they felt like we defeated this thing. And then it came back to life and was different. Right. So it wasn't the same creature twice. Yeah. It was a different monster. And in fact, like, yeah, that battle, if I had just run it by the numbers, it would have been over super quick and that would not have been dramatic or climactic. And I wouldn't have got this cool bad guy that used to be a player. So I often that was her last night in Southern California, just a pure coincidence that her character ended up dying. And now she lives in New Zealand. And so I'll just text her and say, hey, what does Lady Serial do with this? Hey, Lady Serial, here's this one. So she still gets to play her character just, you know, kind of by remote. And I love that kind of that style of play. I love the idea. I love running a game where the big bad guy is actually one of the people I know in the real world. And I give them information and they react to it and they tell me what they want to do. And they're looking at the map and they're like, I want to take this place over. I want to subjugate that baron. I'm like, okay. And we don't have to actually get together and play. We can kind of do it all over text or over IM. But it makes the bad guy feel a lot more real to the players.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it saves me work. I don't have to figure out what does this guy do. I'll just ask my friend. I'll say, hey, what does Lady Serial do?
Very cool. Yeah, and it's got to help to, you know, have other people to play some NPCs once in a while.
Yeah, it's just nice to have a wide selection of players that you can kind of dip into. It's one of the luxuries of running at a game company. I'm the only person at Turtle Rock Studios that has two job titles. They had to change the layout for our business cards. I am the lead writer and it says Dungeon Master.
Nice.
And there are, it's rough because, I may have to do a video about this because there are people who have asked to play in my game that I don't really know. Like, I don't know these people because we're 120 people and it's easy. We have two different floors. It's easy for you to work at the company I work at. I mean, not to really know you. Uh-huh. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't want to tell this guy no. But at the same time, I don't know them that well. And there are other people that I do know and love that I would like to play with. And my boss is like, dude, you're the one that put Dungeon Master in your job title. Right. So like your solutions to this problem got narrowed when you did that, because now you're kind of the semi-official Turtle Rock Dungeon Master. And so you saying no is kind of like Turtle Rock saying, no, you don't get to play D&D.
Yeah. Double-edged sword.
Yeah, it is. It is. I kind of have to say yes. I've got to be like, oh, fine. Okay, sure. Yes.
Now you run in your own campaign world, right?
Yeah. Which I often regret, but yeah.
Why do you regret it?
But just because I don't have the time to, I really believe that putting a map in front of, there's certainly a style of play, and we kind of talk about it in one of the first videos, where you can get started and you can run a game with just a village and what's around that village. Uh-huh. And that's probably the best way to get started with a campaign because it's so little work that you will actually do it.
Right.
As opposed to, oh, I'm gonna be J.R.R. Tolkien and I'm gonna draw. No, if you start from the top down, like my friend Phil, who's also my boss and one of the players in my game, he is getting a campaign ready and he's having the same experience. He's like, I really, really want to do it from the top down. but I just don't have time. I'm like, yeah, that's the thing is I think that players, many players, my players, I as a player prefer to have a big badass map and all this cool stuff to read and all these cool factions and countries and stuff like that, because it gives me, it stimulates my imagination when it comes to making my character and playing my character. Where is my character from? What does he want to do? What are his ambitions? And I don't have the time to really flesh out the world enough. Often my players say they want to do, it works. And the players go, I want to do this thing. And I'm like, oh, now I have to figure out how to do that. Whereas if I had a campaign setting I had bought, like when I ran Birthright, Birthright was the best game I ever ran, I think. And that the fact that I loved that setting and all this work had been done for me, it made it super easy for me to support the players' actions because I knew what was over here. I could just look it up. It took me 5 seconds. I had already read this section. Having to make it all up yourself is a huge pain in the butt.
Yeah, this is true. I'm kind of struggling with that myself. I'm building a world that I started like less than a year ago. And I talk about it a bit on the podcast. And recently I asked on the show, I was like, you know, let me know things about the world that you'd like to see to kind of give me ideas of what to work on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And someone's like, I want to see a map of the world. And I'm like, that would be so awesome, but I'm not a cartographer and my map will not be cool.
No, it won't. It won't. And that's why I like a Hexographer. Actually, Campaign Cartographer has a hex map plugin that you can get, but it still requires you to understand Campaign Cartographer, which no program you have ever used works the way Campaign Cartographer does. But Hexographer is a cheap and simple kind of solution. And I'm going to do a video where I'll probably do it live and stream it. And people in chat I'll be like, okay, what's this mountain range called? And I'll just look in the chat and pick the answer I like. Right. And I'll be like, tell me something interesting about this mountain range that the players don't know. And I'll look in the chat and pick an answer I like. Ah. But like doing it with a Hexographer makes it so that you can pretty quickly produce a map that looks like the old school D&D maps from Greyhawk. And we'll put a lot of cool stuff in front of the players. It won't be pretty. Right. It won't be artistic, but it will have a lot of content in it and it will be fun for the players to engage with. Because otherwise, yeah, that's the problem. Let's imagine that you master the technology required to make the map. You're probably still not an artist,
right?
I'm not an artist. Maybe like my friend Phil is an artist. So his map looks amazing. And he's like, he spent like 3 hours on it. And he's like, oh God, it's not anywhere. No, I'm like, dude, this is already way better than 98% of the maps I've ever seen. Yeah. And he's lamenting how bad it looks. And I'm like, whatever, dude, you know, whatever, artist. Yeah, unless you're an artist, that's the problem, is your campaign map. But I saw somebody on Twitter shared their campaign map with me and they had drawn it in crayon. And I was like, look, whatever works, man.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, I think I made this point in the video, in one of the videos I made, like, it's unlikely that the player characters have a map of the world in their heads, right? There were very few people in before, you know, let's say the 17th century, there were very few people who actually knew where everything in the world was, right? They knew their local area and that was about it. Most people throughout most of history never went more than about 30 miles outside of where they were born.
Yeah.
And so I do believe that there's something to be said for, look, here's the local area. Here's what your characters know. Mm-hmm. But that assumes you're starting at a relatively low level.
Yeah.
If you start at a high level, then yeah, you gotta have a map. That's why I often think, like on every week, I think, man, maybe I should just ditch all this and just go back to Birthright. Right, because I love that setting, and whatever I mean, you listening to this, whatever setting you like you know, there's something to be said for using a pre-generated setting.
Yeah, it's true.
Although it's nice to roll your own. I mean, I'm kind of stuck because I write fantasy novels, and when I decided to write fantasy instead of science fiction, I was like, well, I've got this. I wasn't writing a series of fantasy novels about my D&D game. It didn't really, my novels don't really have anything to do with D&D, but I had a D&D setting that I'd been working on for and been playing in for years. So I'm like, well, what the hell? I'll use that setting, right? Because the actual world didn't matter to me. What mattered to me was the characters and the drama and the conflict. And so now I kind of feel like I'm stuck. Since I write books in this stupid setting, I've got to keep using it.
Yeah, and that reminds me, I will put a link to your books in the show notes too, because you've got two books for sale on Amazon.
Yeah, and I'm working on a third one, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's. I wrote my first novel. I was trying. My friends and I were trying to start our own game company, and we had middling success with that. But one of the things I did just to keep myself sane while we were looking for investment and didn't really have anything to do was I wrote a novel. And I think, like, especially if you're a writer in video games or a writer in movies, you spend a lot of your time compromising and arguing and dealing with money people that aren't artistic and want you to change the work to fit their perception of the need. And so a lot of us in that position just end up writing a novel because then it's ours and no one can tell us what to do with it.
Yeah.
And so that's where that came from. And I'm really happy that I used to, before I started plugging the books in the channel, in the videos, I sold about a book or two a week.
Oh,
and
nice.
Now I'm selling about 10 books a day.
Wow.
And that is crazy. And some of the people, now I'm imagining that a lot of the people who buy the books are literally doing it to support the channel. I don't have a Patreon. This is their way of saying, here's some money. Thanks for making cool content.
Yeah.
And that makes me happy. But some of the people who buy the books read them. And then some of those people like it. And that makes me super happy. The fact that this crazy feedback loop where I sell books and it makes me go, wow, I should make more videos, right? And then I make more videos and I sell more books and I think, wow, I should write another novel, right? And so it's a great problem to have.
Awesome. Now you do a series of videos. It's one of your older series of videos about the history of D&D, one fighter at a time, which I highly recommend people check out.
Oh, thanks.
And you referenced John Peterson's book, Playing at the World, which I got and read and loved.
It's tough. It's a scholarly work.
It's a textbook. Right?
Yeah. It is not a fun book to read. You've got to kind of slog through a lot of stuff, but it's super detailed. And the guy goes into a lot of, it's fascinating to learn about, like, you learn a lot about who Gary Gygax was and how that guy basically, like, you can argue about who invented D&D and who invented role-playing, but inarguably, Gary Gygax invented medieval wargaming.
Yeah.
Like, no one was doing that before he started doing it.
Yeah.
You were either doing Ancients, right, and you were doing the Peloponnesian Wars or whatever, or you were doing Napoleonics and the Civil War or World War II. And so, because no one thought anything interesting happened between those periods.
Yeah. Now, I started playing D&D in the second edition days. I played a little bit of first edition, but I never ran it, never had any of the books. And so, you know, I see some of the, you know, original D&D stuff and even the first edition stuff. And I tend to think, wow, that art is kind of bad. But he made a great point in the book where he actually, or was it you?
It might have been me.
I think it was probably me.
We may both have made the same point.
That you it, right?
Obviously there's nostalgia happening there. However, that being said, and I think I made this point in the video, like there's a great book. It's not a novel, so you can't call it a graphic novel, but it's a comic done by a guy named Scott McCloud. And Scott McCloud's a genius, and he did a graphic book called Understanding Comics, where he talks about visual storytelling. He talks about how does drawing pictures to convey story work? And one of the things he talks about is how the more primitive a work of art is, the more universal it becomes, the more your imagination has to work in order to fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
And it can become a lot more personal to you. If you see something that is a highly detailed, well-composed, well-inked piece of art, then there's very little ambiguity. Right? There's very little room for you, the viewer, to imagine. And I think one of the reasons D&D worked back then was because the art was so primitive that your imagination took over and filled in a lot of the gaps. I feel the same way about minis. I have really nice, highly well-painted miniatures that my friend, but I often yearn for that time where we used like M&Ms, right? Because it forced the players to use their imagination. And I think that creates more powerful memories. I think that when you engage your imagination, everything becomes a lot more real.
So yeah, that was you, because that's exactly what I was getting at. And it made me wonder when we were just talking about, you know, a map for your world, you know, maybe having, you know, this really crude map drawn in crayon kind of invokes that same kind of, like, you have to use your imagination.
A lot of handout maps in various modules that I've seen that they did in the 70s and 80s, the map is actually a person in the campaign drew this hand. Right. And so they've only marked the landmarks they know about. And I think that's cool, but I think, you know, there are limits to how far you can go. And I think in this day and age with GPS and kind of the perfect knowledge of the world around us, I think players tend to get frustrated with that. And they really want to know, show me the map. And the kind of wow factor of putting a really cool, well-drawn, highly detailed map in front of the players is hard to beat.
Yeah, that's true. I was just trying to find some kind of, you know,
some kind of hope for us non-cartographers out there.
Well, like I said, Hexographer is super easy because you're just clicking on hexes, right? You don't have to, you don't draw anything.
Okay.
And that makes it so that you can make a pretty big map that has a lot of detail without having to actually draw anything. You're just saying, you're just like painting planes. I'll paint a desert over here. I could paint a road over here. And I can drop a castle here. I can drop a ruined keep here. I can put a cave here. And it's really straightforward. And if you like, and I do, that kind of old school hex map look like you got in the old Greyhawk adventures, then it looks fantastic.
Awesome. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna do a Hexographer video. I recommended Dungeonographer in one of my videos. That was a mistake. Dungeonographer is not that good a piece of software, but Hexographer is actually pretty cool.
Oh, you know, I actually got Dungeonographer on your recommendation, but I haven't played with it yet. So maybe I'll just skip it.
Man, it's graph paper is better. Like there is no, I said in the video I put up today, I point out that like there is no good dungeon building solution. And I think it's just because there have not been enough DMs out there in the past to create enough demand for someone to take the job seriously of making that software.
Yeah. So just draw it on paper, huh?
graph paper is, it's pretty straightforward, man.
Yeah.
You know, like it's pencil and graph paper is really easy.
Yeah. If you really want to get complicated, get a straight edge and a compass.
Right. And keep in mind that like, I think 5 minutes work will find lots of great dungeon maps online.
Yeah.
Some of which are from adventures, but some of which are just maps people have drawn intending you to populate them. And I think that stuff is great.
Cool. Awesome. Well, we've brought it up a few times. Do you want to tell the listener who doesn't already know a little bit about your YouTube channel?
Yeah, I have a YouTube channel that is doing pretty well. I'm pretty impressed with the response I've gotten so far. And the goal of the channel is just to get people who want to play D&D to think instead that they could run D&D and have fun. Because, I mean, I do it for purely selfish reasons. I'm at work at Turtle Rock Studios. I'm surrounded by nerds, but I'm the only person who is comfortable DMing. And that bugs me. That's how you get burned out.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the DM needs to play. And I come from a tradition where, you know, not everybody, but like 3 out of every 5 players would also be a DM. And so if you got burned out running, you stopped and somebody else ran. And the thing is, while you are playing, you are recharging your batteries and watching, being a player, watching someone else DM really makes you want to, you're like, oh man, I want to run again.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I was like, I'm tired of there not being enough. I'm tired of people asking me to run a game for them. My answer is you should run a game. And so I said, screw it. I'm going to start a YouTube channel.
Awesome. Yeah. And your videos are very helpful and start at square one and go from there.
Yeah, I did. I recorded 4 videos before I put any of them up because I wanted somebody who came to the channel for the first time early on. I wanted them to find a lot of content. And I just want to try to tell people like, look, it's not that hard. And in fact, you can make it a lot easier if you just try not to imagine the perfect D&D game, because if that's what you have in your head, right? If you have that map that looks like the Lord of the Rings map, if you watch Critical Role and think, I want to be a DM the way Matt Mercer is, you're never going to start, right? You don't have to, that is a place you can get to, right? You can start tonight, just get your friends together. I said the typical group doesn't get past 5 encounters, but realistically, what do you think? I don't think most groups get past 2 encounters in a 4-hour period. Like it's super rare to me to do 5 encounters a night. So if you have 2 encounters ready, you're probably good to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been rare. I've gotten through 5 encounters in 4 hours.
Yeah. You have to have if they're in a dungeon and they're just going room to room, then yes.
Yeah.
But the players like role-playing, they like talking to each other. Right. And so you spend a lot of your time just sitting back, letting them do their thing. Right. They're talking in character or they're arguing about what to do next. And so you don't need to have a ton of content ready. I think that getting over the hump of starting is the hardest thing. Once you're actually running the game, it's a lot easier. But you just, we all build it up as this huge thing, but it's not. I think that it's funny. I think sometimes I think the guys on Critical Role set a bad example because normal people, normal civilians don't know this is not normal. This is not what normal D&D is like.
Right.
That's why I really want to record myself running the game. Cause I think if people saw me running the game, they would go, oh yeah, I can do that. That's stupid. I'd be like, yeah, of course you can. That's the point.
Yeah. Well, if you need any help with that, let me know. I've had a little experience with recording games.
It's going to be tricky. We have, we set up at work, we have our own Twitch stream at Turtle Rock Studios.
Okay.
And so we have all the technology at work to record a live game and stream it. And we did a test at work. It's just a pain in the butt. It's a lot of work on top of actually running the game.
Yeah.
But like we have a setup not entirely unlike the one that Critical Role has, where everyone's together in the same room, but there'd be cameras on different players. Okay. There'd be a camera on me. And we've done a couple of tests. It's just, you know, like I said, it's going to be a pain in the butt.
Yeah. You know, I think an easier way to do it is to run the game online using something like Roll20 or Google Hangouts.
Yeah, I've tried that. I've spent a lot of time in Fantasy Grounds, which is my preferred virtual tabletop.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But I do think that there's something about playing in person. Like there's a certain emotional attachment to what's happening that I think you lose. When this is very esoteric, like if the only way you can play is online, play online, you'll have a blast.
Yep.
But I think playing in person, it does take on a greater significance in your mind. Yeah. The fact that all these other players are there, you can look at their faces, you can respond to them. I watched, Chris Perkins running, and I see this even in his game, like the game he runs. For Curse of Strahd, mm-hmm. doesn't have the same level of immediacy that the Acquisitions Incorporated game has,
yeah.
because the players aren't face-to-face. So I have players face-to-face. We have the technology to do it all live, and we will give that a shot, but that's going to be further on down the line. Like the first step is just going to be put a camera on me and record me running the game. And you'll be able to hear the other players, but I won't have cameras on them.
Cool.
And my goal, ultimately, when I first started this channel, I thought it was going to be mostly me recording my session and then editing it down to use as B-roll for examples in these videos. And I haven't even done that once yet. So we have a long way to go with this channel, I think.
Yeah, well, it's a great channel. I've seen a lot of...
I'm glad you like it, man. I'm really glad you like it.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of, you know, D&D YouTube channels. And as far as, you know, what you do, it's the best I've seen.
Oh, wow. Thanks. I mean, yeah. I think I got I'm kind of cheating in that... you know, I got a modest bonus at work, and I thought my friend Jay, who does his own YouTube videos, I'm like, I want to do that. And so I went out and I bought a nice camera, right? And I sat there and I had a podcast for a couple of years, so I have a really nice audio setup, and I got nice lights. And so by the time I was ready to shoot, I could make a video that looked okay. Right. I think that there's a long way to go. But when you compare it to a lot of the other DIY videos, I think I do have a leg up on them just in terms of production quality.
Yeah.
But that's because I spent money, right? That's the trick. There's no shortcut there.
Well, I think your production is good enough that it doesn't get in the way of the content, and your content is excellent, which is really where it's at, I think.
Well, that makes me very happy. I mean, we'll see how long I can keep it up. Sometimes I think I'm almost out of things to talk about, and then other times I think we could do this forever. There's so much to cover. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
It's funny. I go through the same thing with this podcast. In fact, it was just a few weeks ago. I was telling my wife, I'm like, I'm running out of things to talk about. I don't know what to talk about anymore. And now I have so many ideas. I don't know when I'm going to get to them all.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things we're lucky, like one of the things I tell you, if you have a YouTube channel, is that you want content that's evergreen.
Yeah.
And the great thing about these D&D videos is these things may think about this, Lex, this stuff we're doing may live on after us. Right. Like I may die. Well, I'm certainly going to die, but I mean, but people might still be watching my videos. People have been playing D&D for I think now over 40 years.
Yeah.
So they could be playing D&D for the next 40 years, and there are going to be DMs that need advice. And a lot of this advice is universal. It has nothing to do with fifth edition. It has nothing to do with this or that adventure. Yeah. Whereas some of my favorite YouTubers, like Marcus Brownlee, who is my favorite tech reviewer online, like he records a smartphone. He does a video about this new smartphone, and 3 months later, that video is obsolete.
Yeah.
Right. And he's got millions of subscribers. So it makes me think that, like, you know, there's people will engage with this content and watch or listen to all of it. You know, however much you make, they will listen to it. So you might as well just keep doing it.
Yeah. I didn't even think about it like outliving us, but you're definitely right.
I mean, like unless something happens to YouTube, right? Like, or unless we become immortal, like people 50 years from now might be watching our stuff, might be listening to our stuff and being like, oh, I'm a better DM now. It's crazy to me that people who this is super weird to me that there, I had a friend of mine at work. Now, of course, this is only going to happen with my friends right now, like come up to me and ask me to sign his DM's guide. And then wow. Matt Mercer plays a voice in the game. That's how I know him. And so he came down to Turtle Rock to record some VO for us, and he had Matt Mercer sign. He goes, "I just want to get you and Matt and Chris Perkins to sign my DM's guide." And the idea that there are people out there who hold me in the same level of esteem as those two guys blows my mind.
Yeah.
But it makes me think that they're like, look, this is, if you do it, they will come. And people in Brazil watch my show. People are going to be, my cat's meowing. My cat's telling me it's time to go. People are going to be watching these videos for a long time. And it kind of embarrasses me to look back at some of the older videos now and see how only a month I've gotten better with, composition and stuff like that. So it's kind of like, oh God, I wish I knew then what I know now. But I knew that going into it. It's like being a DM. You can't let that dream of the perfect, thing get in the way of just doing it. Otherwise, you'll never get started.
Yeah. Great advice. Awesome. Well, I will, in the show notes, I'll include links to the videos we discussed, your channel, your books on Amazon. Where can people find you? You're on Twitter, I'm sure.
I am. I'm at Matt Colville on Twitter. It's probably the best place to contact me. If you want to just, say hi. And you can find, if you go to Twitter, I also have a link in my profile to my YouTube channel.
Awesome. One of the things that makes this podcast awesome is feedback from you. I would love to hear from you. If you've got any comments about today's episode or the show in general, or you've got any ideas, or you just want to say hi, shoot me an email at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter @LexStarwalker. Find me on Google+ LexStarwalker. Check out my website, starwalkerstudios.com. And from there, you can find a link to the Game Master's Journey Google+ community, which I really strongly encourage you to join. We have a lot of great discussions there and inspirations and all kinds of RPG goodness. You can also find my D&D actual play, currently running Curse of Strahd, on my YouTube channel, and you can find a link to that in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com as well. I want to send a huge thank you and shout out to my Tier 6 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve. Yeah. Woo! Oh, Steve. Yes. He's amazing. So Steve is awesome, and Steve is just one of the many outstanding patrons that support Game Master's Journey and Starwalker Studios. And I really appreciate the patrons. So if you enjoy this fine podcast coming in your ear holes right now, I really appreciate any support people can give. And a great way to help out is becoming a patron. So you can check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/Starwalker Studios. And in addition to just helping out and keeping the Obsidian Monolith running, patrons get some really cool perks for supporting the show, including a special monthly podcast that I produce just for the patrons, as well as access to original game material that I come up with and more. So check it out. Thanks again, Matthew, for coming on the show today. I really, really appreciate it. What a fantastic interview. I had a lot of fun, and you, sir, are welcome back anytime. So Matthew has a series of videos for new GMs that start at square one and give you a lot of great tips and advice. So if you're a brand new GM, or if you're a player who's never run a game, but you're willing to give it a shot or at least consider it, definitely check out his videos. And I know Matthew and I both hope that you'll give it a try. And even if you're a more experienced GM, check out his videos anyway, because I've been running games for decades and I've learned a lot from watching his videos. Also on his YouTube channel, he's got a really cool series of videos called The History of D&D One Fighter at a Time, where he makes a fighter in each version of the game, starting with the original 1974 Dungeons & Dragons. And as he does so, there's a lot of great discussion about how the game has evolved over the years. And I really enjoyed that series of videos and ended up getting this tome of a book that Matthew talked about on the videos that really goes into the history of D&D. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. It's called Playing at the World. And that'll be an Amazon referral link. So if you click on that and go to Amazon and buy that or anything else, that helps support Starwalker Studios too. And I really appreciate you using those links. But it's a fantastic book. It is, like we said in the interview, it's like reading a textbook complete with footnotes and everything. It's not exactly light reading. But if you're really interested in the history of D&D and the history of role-playing games, it's a fantastic read. And I have learned so much about the game from this book. It's really, in some ways, kind of fundamentally changed the way I look at the game now that I have this much better context of history of, you know, what the game was, what it has been, and what it is now, and kind of what it all means. So these are things I imagine I will talk about at some point on the show, but really fascinating stuff. But definitely check out those videos. It's a lot easier to digest than reading the book, that's for sure. So you can find links to his YouTube channel and some of the videos in show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. I'll also have links to Matthew's books on Amazon. He's got two books that he's put out so far that are fantasy novels that you should definitely check out. The first one is called Priest, and the second one's called Thief. And there are more coming. So I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week, and I hope you give running the game a shot if you haven't already. And if you are already a game master, I hope that you learned as much from this interview today as I did. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Tranceboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.